Welcome, everyone, to the Our Strange Skies podcast. I am your host, Rob Christofferson, and joining me again, he can't get enough of the subduction stuff. It's Rich Adam, man. Welcome back.
Hi, I am so happy to be back. Yeah, I don't know, Rob. I guess I just want to stay away. You're going to have to put up with me a little longer.
That's fine. The people seem to love it anyway. I get requests often for when is Rich going to be back? So,
really? The people yeah. like me?
They do.
Nice. Yeah. All right. Tell them to reach out on Twitter.
Reach out to Rich on Twitter. He loves it. He loves it when you shower him with praise for everything he's done.
Give me that Our Strange Skies love.
Yeah. So today we're talking about two specific kind of abductee contactees that we feel kind of deserve their own episode, especially with Herbert Schirmer, because his case is so interesting, and it's kind of got it's a little, I don't know, I wouldn't say heartwarming, but it has a little heart to it, just in the like what he endured and kind of the nature of his contact experience. But, with Albert Coe, like you brought this one to the table. What exactly is this story? You know, because like, let's just paint a picture here. Like this is, his book comes out in what, 1969, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is like a time when like contactees really aren't as prevalent as they were like from the 50s until like the early 60s, I would say.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it's like, I didn't know. Well, okay. So my story, cause I suggested this, but I didn't really know what I was talking about, which is not new for you, Rob. You sort of, Well, what happened was a year or so back, I'm always, as you are, kind of trolling the internet for old UFO books, because I collect them, you collect them. We know a few other people who like to, you know, own the, I started when I bought the George Adamski and was it Desmond Leslie, the book?
Yeah.
And it's got the UFO. And I'm like, oh, that's the coolest looking book. And this was like 25 years ago or something. And then I decided, oh, I should collect these. So anyway, a couple of years ago, there was this book available through, I think it was ABE Books, which is one of those, you know, internet antiquarian bookseller sites. And this one was this extremely rare, super expensive, you know, almost self-published book by Albert Coe. It came out in 1969, but it was about experiences he had back in the 20s, basically. And it was a first edition, great condition, book jacket in great condition, and signed by Albert Coe. So the description of the book is like, look, I mean, this book is rare to begin with, much less in this condition. Signed, it may be entirely unique. There may not be another copy in existence, therefore the big price tag. So my birthday was coming up, you know, and I'd had a pretty good year. You know, Titan's doing okay going into year four. You know, the residuals pouring in. So, yeah. Mr. Godrocks over here goes to Susan and says, Susan, my birthday's coming up. You buy. She's like, oh my God, what the hell is this? I'm like, none of your business. Just buy it for me. So, It's this book called The Shocking Truth by Albert Coe. And the painting on the cover is of a young man sitting by the side of he's sitting actually in front of a fire, a little campfire. And in the sky is a UFO.
It's right there. It's hanging out.
Yeah. It's kind of, but it's a very relaxed setting. Anyway, so my understanding when I got this book was that it was about an abduction, and that the unique part about it was that the abduction took place in the 20s and therefore, placed it decades before the more popular, well-known abduction cases that we talked about last time. So I got really excited about it. I bought, so the book arrived for my birthday. I got it. It's in a plastic bag, unopened. Did not touch the book. Had no intention of ever reading the book. I just wanted to have it, look at it, see the signature, and display it on my little credenza over there. Then you come along.
Yep.
Hey, we're doing early abductions. I'm like, yeah, what about Albert Coe? You're like, fine. I found a PDF. Here it is. So now I've printed it. I'm like, oh. So now I print out 120 pages of this book. I actually read the book. Oh boy, let me tell you, The Shocking Truth. Not that shocking, probably not that true. So now who's holding the bag?
Richard Haddam is holding it now.
Don't tell Susan. Don't tell Susan.
We were pretty fortunate to actually find a PDF copy, because I think it was the Saucer Life that had actually done an episode on it, and I think that's where I found the PDF. But like, I tell you, PDFs are lifesavers when it comes to finding like rare books, and like if you can find PDFs online and stuff, it's a very handy thing, as is the resource page on OurStrangeSkies.com. I will never stop plugging that. Like, it is seriously one of the best digital resources pages. I'm still freaking amassing shit. So it's going to end up on there. But yeah, like, you got the PDF, and like a nerd, you printed it out. So that's pretty great.
Well, I knew I'd be taking notes because, Professor Christofferson wants to see my work, not just, read the answer. He wants to see how I arrived at the answer, which is what all good teachers do. So I knew I had to fucking, yeah. Well, I wasn't going to read 100 pages online. Look, I'm old fashioned. Okay. Call me old fashioned. In fact, make me an old fashioned. I'm getting thirsty. Anyway. So I printed it out. I read it. And let me just tell you, let's start. I know we're going to talk about Shermer. Can we start with Coe? Because now that I'm this far into my, tirade. Yep. Look, this book is sincerely written, and written at a fairly high level. The prose is kind of lugubrious. It's in that sort of highfalutin tone of early in the century. We're not talking Hemingway or Hammett's stripped down prose. We're talking about, why use 5 words when 55 will do?
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Now, what we have here, and you and I talked about this a little bit, this is ultimately a contactee manifesto. Mm-hmm. Here's what's interesting about it. I mean, there's a lot of interesting things about it, but to start with the abduction angle, because as I was flipping through it, there's illustrations. He got a guy to paint a few panels of what he's trying to express. And it shows a guy basically dressed sort of in a suit, pointing at a bunch of screens. And what I understood from the caption was that these screens were on the craft. And that he's sort of pointing at them, and there's various, things showing up on the screen. So I'm like, oh shit, he really was abducted. But he actually wasn't. He specifically wasn't. He has contact with this guy, and we'll talk about the guy in a second. But this guy says, okay, one of the rules is I can't let you on my craft. You cannot come on the UFO. You're not allowed.
Interesting.
But I am now going to describe in, let me tell you, excruciating detail what the inside of the craft looks like, and I'm going to take you on a pretend tour of it. So come with me in your imagination as we walk up the steps and emerge into a room which is approximately 150 feet side to side, but circular in shape, with lights emanating from the wall. And then he begins a pages and pages and pages description as we take a tour of the inside of the ship. That's all just being verbally described to him by the space person. But he never, ever, ever goes on the ship. He sees it parked, he sees it take off, he sees it flying, but he's never allowed on because that's one of the rules. So this guy on no level can be considered an abductee. He is full contactee and definitely of the benevolent space brother variety. So that's what we're dealing with Albert Coe.
This is an example of telling and not showing, like, completely.
It's the exact opposite of what I'm trying to do in my work, yeah. Which is show, not tell. Right. Yeah. Did you read any of this book at all?
I read a little bit of it. I didn't have time to read the whole thing, but it is highfalutin. I will say that. It's kind of pretty. A little pretty, but very wordy,
and not the ramblings of a madman. I mean, it's not incomprehensible gibberish. He doesn't sound insane, but look, I'm no physicist. I'm no astrophysicist. He goes deep into the weeds about traveling through galaxies and exactly how this is done and where these people come from and how they get from one place to the next. And it gets pretty dense. I'd be fascinated if somebody with a background in any of these fields read this book and could make heads or tail out of it. It sounds like it could make sense, but I really have no ability on my own to evaluate it on that level. I can evaluate the prose. I'll tell you what it sounds like. You know some of those books that are channeled material?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where it gets into this sort of very sort of lordy, flowery speak, you know, and it sounds like that. Mm-hmm. But I don't know anything. I could not dig up anything about Albert Coe, who he was. I was not able to find anything about him. I'm sure it's out there, and I didn't spend days looking, but I don't know what his background is. I don't know what he did for a living, but his claim is that he made contact when he was a very young man, like basically a teenager, with this guy, this space guy who sort of looks just like us, real good looking, very Aryan, blue eyes, blonde hair. Mm-hmm. Who emerges as like an older brother type, or maybe the cool friend of my older brother, you know, kind of a, yeah. You know, kind of like, oh, this guy's kind of what I want to be when I'm 21, but I'm only 16 now. You know, he seems to know, he knows how to do things and he's smart and he's had a more exciting life than me, but he's talking to me. Okay, here's how they meet. Albert Coe and a friend of his about his age are out, it's summertime and they're canoeing in Canada, in, I think, Ontario. So this might be north of Toronto. And one day, and they're just making, it's 1920. They don't have, you know, any kind of GPS. They're just sort of finding their way based on maps and what they've heard. But they know kind of where they want to go and where they want to camp that night. It's sort of over in that direction. But it's going to be tough going. we can take the northern route or the southern route to sort of get across these woods. So what they said was, okay, Albert's like, you go this way, I'll go that way. We'll each go a couple of miles and then come back and sort of report back on how difficult the going is. And we'll decide on what path to take. So Albert goes one way, his buddy goes the other. Albert's walking along, gets a few miles down the road and gets to a particularly sort of tough, kind of, there's a big rocky outcropping, sort of a big rocky hill and a dense forest on the other side. And he's like, I don't know what to do. And then he hears a sound. And it sounds like the sound of rocks kind of tumbling down on the other side of this sort of rock pile. So he starts moving up the rock pile, and then he starts hearing a voice going, oh, help me, please help me. And he's like, I am in the middle of nowhere. Like, we haven't seen another human being for days. And now I'm hearing someone who sounds like they're about 20 yards away calling out. So he's like, hello. And the guy's like, oh my God, come help me, help me, help me. So Albert goes over this rocky hill and starts descending down the other side. And he sees this guy, just looks like a guy, sort of stuck, like up to his chest in a crevice between two rocks. And the guy's like, oh my God, you got to help me. You got to help me. Albert goes down there, and it takes a lot of work to get this guy dislodged. He actually has to like find a piece of rope and sort of tie it around the guy's chest under his arms, and then put it up over a big long branch, and then use the branch as a lever to sort of pry the guy up out of this crevice. He manages to do it, and the guy is like, this is a miracle. I got stuck here. I've been here for days. I literally expected to die. I haven't eaten. I haven't had any water. The fact that you came along in this remote area is absolutely impossible. The odds are incalculable, but you have saved my life. Now, meanwhile, Albert is noticing that this guy, while looking normal, is sort of dressed in a one-piece gray jumpsuit. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
But he looks just like us. There's nothing gray about him. You know, he's just a guy. But this outfit that he's wearing has this square panel on the chest. And the panel looks like it's got a bunch of wires. He helps the guy. Albert is like, I was feeling really weird this whole time. Like, even I was sort of struck at how weird it was to meet someone out here in the middle of nowhere. And then the guy said he was just here to go fishing. He said, oh, could you get my pole? Well, I went and got his pole, but it was a fishing pole unlike any I'd ever seen. It was sort of all of a piece, and it looked a little shorter than a normal fishing pole, almost like a wand of some sort. And all of my flags are waving. It's just like, okay, red flag, you know, the wiry panel, you know, the weird wand looking thing, the Oz factor of all of this was seeming really strange. A voice calling from the woods. I mean, that's straight out of every fairy story you've ever heard.
Yeah.
Well, this guy says, I got here because I landed my plane in a field just on the other side of those trees. And I came here to go fishing, and I slipped on these rocks and got caught. And that was it. And Albert's like, this story sounds like bullshit. How could this be? You know, where are you going to land a plane? Because this is all pretty dense. Like, I can't, you would have to have like a lot of space, hundreds of yards, maybe a quarter mile to land any kind of a plane. Finally, he's in their conversation. He says, can I see this plane? The guy's like, you don't want to see the plane. I can't show you the plane. I really want to see the plane. And the guy's like, okay, look, you saved my life. I owe you this much. You can come see the plane. So they walk through the forest and emerge into a small field. And there is, for all intents and purposes, a flying saucer. And Albert's like, I don't get it. What is this? He's like, well, that's my plane. It's a new experimental model. The two of them walk up to it. Albert's like, it was circular. It had a dome on top. It was on three sort of legs with flat little feet. You know, then he presses a button and a door opens and some stairs come down. It's a classic UFO.
Yep.
The guy says, I would love to bring you inside and show you what the inside of this experimental plane looks like, but I can't. I don't have time. I've got to go get back to my people. But one day our paths will cross again. And he goes and he gets inside and Albert walks back to the trees 50 yards away and watches as this thing starts to hover and then wobble, kind of like a falling leaf, and then zoom off into the sky. And he's so excited. And he goes back and later on that day meets up with his friend. And it's like, you know, and by the way, the guy, our space brother had said, well, when I landed, I saw that there's a passable route to the north. And that's your best bet if that's where you're going. So when Albert meets up with his friend who scouted the northern passageway, his friend goes, yeah, we can go get through this way. So Albert's like, well, now that's weird. So because this guy, before he got back into his experimental spacecraft, said that from the air, he saw there was a passable way. And now that's been confirmed by my friend. So all of this is sort of connecting up.
Mm-hmm.
He's in a great mood for the next few days. They're having this wonderful canoe trip. He and his friend are having a great time. And he keeps thinking about that weird guy he met. And then one day, like the picture on the cover of the book, his friend goes to sleep one night. They've had their dinner. And now as the fire is sort of dying and he's looking up into the sky, wondering about his friend, here comes the UFO. And it sort of tilts back and forth a little bit in the sky like it's waving at him. And then it zooms off again. And he's like, I knew that my friend was visiting me and somehow knew I was thinking about him. Then it gets weirder because then he goes home, forgets about his friend until his friend calls on the phone and says, let's get together and meet.
That's, you know, that it's great. Like this alien's a stalker. Just a stalker now. Like,
oh my God. So stalkery.
Yeah.
Actually, you know what? Here, I'm going to show you something in my notes. I may have, I'm sorry. I got the sequence wrong. First he, here it is. First he sends him a letter. Then he gets the phone call. I received a letter signed. This was the signature of his space friend. Here's how this guy spells his name. Now, I'm going to spell it and you write it down. Okay, Rob? Do you have a pencil or a pen?
I will write it down in my notes here.
Okay, write it down in your notes. Okay. His name is spelled Xretsim. Does that mean anything to you?
No.
Well, try reading it backwards.
Oh, no, not Mr. X. No. Mr. X is making an appearance.
Wow. Now, I read that. The minute I see a weird alien name, I always read it backwards or try to find the anagram. So within 1 second, I look at this and I'm like, you got to be fucking kidding me. Mr. X spelled backwards. This is where we're going. I got 100 more pages of this bullshit. On the very next page, he goes, well, of course, I knew immediately that this was not his real name, for it was nothing but Mr. X spelled backwards. And I'm like, oh. Okay. All right. He's admitting right up front that we're playing word games. All right.
So he's in on the joke. I appreciate that. Like he's maintaining what we call kayfabe for anybody that watches professional wrestling, you know, and like trying to maintain the illusion. This is what he's doing.
Yeah. Well, what's fun is that, so he gets the phone call, and now he and this and his space brother, Mr. X, meet up at a diner outside Terrytown.
Really? Terrytown?
Yeah. Now, how close are you to Terrytown?
I'm a few, maybe like 3 hours away, I would say.
Okay. That, yeah. Rob, how come every time I ask you anything about where you are, you're 3 hours away?
It's a mysterious thing. I'm like more towards the north, but like it's interesting that they're meeting in Headless Horseman kind of territory. I appreciate that.
I know. So here's what it says in the book. We stopped at a diner outside Terrytown to have a bite of breakfast. While we were eating, he remarked, "By the way, did you figure the name out?" It was quite by accident, but I had, for the Christmas card was sitting on my bureau and it had tipped over with its face to the mirror. And as I combed my hair, there in plain English was Mr. X. I picked up the card, and an implication I had not given a thought to was plain to see. Excretium was Mr. X spelled backwards. He asked how I had explained the gift, because a gift was sent to him by this guy. He asked how I had explained the gift, for although it was an involuntary impulse of the heart, realized afterwards that it was also a bit thoughtless. I told him, oh, that was easy, for it was credited to one of my girlfriends in New York, and that we had a secret code, which is often used in our correspondence. So there's something oddly covert and borderline romantic between these two. Now, it never goes that way. I was hoping this was going to turn into, you know, my lover from outer space, but that isn't where it went. But emotionally, that is kind of how this feels. He begins to meet with this guy, okay? And they have several different meetings, sometimes months, sometimes years apart. And each time they meet, he's got all these questions, and this guy goes on at length with these long, complicated, extremely mathematically and scientifically detailed answers for how his spaceship flies, what's inside the spaceship, why it's there, and then ultimately, what is this guy doing here? Okay, so now I will kind of finish up the tale of Albert Coe. The story is this. These guys have always existed. They live longer lifespans than we do, and they come from a planet way, way, way out in outer space. Okay. A group of 100 of them, I think, came here in 1904. And they came here for the purpose of making sure we don't destroy ourselves, or at least helping us not destroy ourselves. Because they look like us and because they are somewhat immortal, they've been able to distribute themselves around our world and embed themselves in various positions of scientific, importance. They're able to sort of get into places. And while they can't exactly kibosh anything we're doing, like they can't make sure we don't learn how to split the atom, they can try to influence our understanding of the world so that we'll be more reluctant to destroy ourselves. It's kind of like the Star Trek thing. It's sort of like, well, we can be here and we can sort of try to kind of nudge you in one direction or another, but we can't just, you know, knock over the beaker so you never figure out what's inside of it.
Right.
Now, they've got five rules. Complete freedom of action by these 100 technicians was limited by a set of five inviolate rulings and subtitles for the duration of their stay on Earth. Any infraction to these rules would subject the violator to immediate recall, and if unforeseen events necessitated an amendment to procedure, only a majority vote by the council could rescind or change its stipulations. Okay, picture 100 pages of writing that's basically like that. Okay, yep. So here they are. The following is a general transcript of its basic embodiment. 1. Secrecy of identity was paramount. intervention or instigation of any change in our way of life, meaning human way of life, was strictly forbidden. To willfully participate in armed conflict, to divulge any secret of physics or chemistry that may even remotely aid in an expansion of military potential, or to direct or assist in the planning of a military strategy was also forbidden. 3. No man of Earth was permitted entrance to a spacecraft. Okay, so we heard about that. Mm-hmm. 4. This one's amazing. 4 is, due to possibility of a maximum duration of this mission, marriage with Earth women was permitted. I mean, come on.
When in Rome, right? We can't influence anything. We can't influence anything.
But no, but you can't tell us.
We're here for.
We can't keep our paws off the women folk. Come on. We're out here for a long time, guys. Okay, but a specific element in the chemistry of the body, the alien's body, was electronically treated to prevent the occurrence of offspring. Permanent roots would not be tolerated.
Mm.
So they could get busy, but they couldn't, you know.
Yeah.
At a certain point, you got to say goodbye and move off. Okay, and then five, the fifth rule, to always conduct themselves as gentlemen, and the mannerisms, thought, kindness, and tolerance of their own philosophies be extended in all dealings with our people, and to assist in any invention or philosophy of our own creation that may bring a benefit of happiness to the races of Earth.
Okay.
So that's their rule.
So there's like this like dichotomy here of like, well, we can't influence your, we can't give you like weapons for, but if it's going to help you, we're cool. Like this is, right. This is so, it's so weird. We can't allow you on our UFOs, but we can marry any woman we want.
Right. And when they say marry, I think we all know what they're really saying.
Right.
You know, when they want to get some of that sweet earth trim, they're allowed to. Because by the way, it's only men. This delegation, all men, no women. Jesus. So it's not like, and of course, the women of our delegation are allowed also to claim a husband. No reference to that.
Of course not. Of course not. Yeah, that sounds about right. That's definitely it's a complete sausage fest, basically, on this with these folks. Yeah,
but they've been electronically treated so as not to have offspring. So they got the space vasectomy.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, and okay. So this is all taking place. This information that he's being given is mostly in the 1920s. He is told by his space brother, you know, you can't talk about this. This is our secret. Like, you can know this, but nobody else. And the only reason I'm telling you is because of the fortuitous way in which we met. I mean, if it wasn't for you, I would have died. So I'm going to tell you this stuff, but you can't tell anyone else. It was only immediately prior to the writing and publication of this book that he was given dispensation from his space brother, Mr. X, to finally inform the Earth of what has been going on and what is going on and what could happen in the future. So that's why he ultimately then wrote this book and put it out into the world.
Interesting. I do appreciate the sketches that are in it, because there are sketches of these aliens and their UFOs over primitive man, like showing up and hovering over. Yeah.
They have been a part of our development all the way along. And at an earlier point, one of these prehistoric men or some version of early primitive man got a hold of something that was a part of their technology and triggered an event. Okay.
Or
almost triggered an event, but in any case, the self-destructive nature of man based on his voracious curiosity and need for power was then demonstrated to these aliens, who then learned that that's what we're all about, and that that's the instinct through which they must intervene. And within this text, it's recognized that, well, it's the yin and the yang. It's the dark side, but then you also have this thing called love, you know? And so mm-hmm. we are here to kind of negotiate between these two impulses, which human impulse will win out. If it's the destructive, well, then all is lost. If it's the other, love, anything's possible. And that's what they're trying to negotiate.
Interesting. Okay, so they really bungled this thing because there were two world wars after they showed up. Just saying.
Right. I mean, that's what I thought. I'm like, well, let's just take a little flip through the history books. But then there's always the sort of, yes, but you haven't destroyed yourselves. Not yet. You know, you are being given the opportunity to decide. We're not deciding for you. We're gonna let you, we will stand by as you develop a weapon that can destroy all life on Earth hundreds of times over. But will you press the button? And as of this date, what is today, Rob? Wednesday, October 26th, the year 2022, we have not done it. We have not destroyed ourselves yet.
Thank you to these aliens for allowing us to record a podcast decades later about this entire thing, because clearly they have succeeded. Granted, those two world wars and that, you know, the nuclear bomb, not really high, great points for them. But you know what? We're still here for now. Wow. We'll see how long that lasts. But you know what? Good on them, I guess. Like, it's
the weird circular philosophy. It's like, yeah. It's like, okay, a war was fought. Horrible atrocities were committed throughout the war and all the way up to and including the use of the bombs at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Okay, the Earth, human beings as a race survive, the Earth as a planet survives, but what did we learn from that terrible conflagration? You know, did we learn anything? I don't know. Maybe we did. Maybe we didn't. You know, here we are. You know, other wars take place. Have we learned? Will we learn? We don't know.
And I think what we've learned is that Albert Coe is full of shit. But you know what? I appreciate his story regardless. Because it's pretty, it's flowery, it's a typical contactee story.
You can't prove he's wrong.
No, I can't. But, you know.
Isn't the burden really on you, Rob, to prove every aspect of Albert Coe's story is made up?
Yeah, it's a cold case that I am not competent to investigate. I am not a cold case detective. But either way, like, it is. It's your typical kind of. I think what separates him is that, like, were there any contactees saying that they had contacts back in the 1920s, whereas, like, most of them had contacts, you know, in the 1950s. But he has gotten up. He's going over to grab a book.
This is a new paperback. Yes. A is for Adamski. Yep. You've got this one.
Yep.
This is the Greg Bishop, Adam Go Rightly book. And you know, it never even occurred to me to look up our friend Albert Coe. Let's see if he's
Live, folks. He is doing this right now. He is going to the seas.
Gray Barker, ABF. Nope. There is no reference to Albert Coe. There are no people with the last. Let's see if there's any reference in the index to Albert Coe.
Does your shirt have an Adamski saucer on it?
Yeah, it does. Hang on.
Okay.
Detroit Cole.
Flying Saucer Club. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, isn't this, Tenney?
Yep.
I may have gotten it through John Tenney. Yeah.
Excellent. There it is. It's glorious. Fantastic.
So yeah. So Coe is not well known.
No.
But his story is part of it. Look, I've got Adamski's books. I you know, if some George Van Tassel comes on the market, I'll buy it. I've got Orfeo Angelucci. So do you. The story of the contactees is part of the story of UFOs that you and I both study and you know. It has to be taken into account where were all the positive stories before the 1950s of contactees? Well, this appears to be one, but it wasn't reported until 1969. So it's hard to separate. You can't say this is a clean, isolated case that is totally divorced from the contactee literature of the 50s. You know, then we move into the stories of the abductees, you know, who have negative experiences. You know, it's all part of the rich UFO pageant. But even though this goes back to the 20s, it's a tough one to figure out. I cannot say it's legit on any level. What it looks like is a guy who wrote a book in 1968 that was influenced by the contactee movement. And he predated his a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate the illustrations. I really do, because they are really good. And
they are credited to Thomas Lulevich. He's the one who did the illustrations. And they're kind of eerie, but sort of great.
Yeah. Like I am a fan of a good UFO illustration. I've talked on this podcast about diving into issues of Canadian UFO Report, which is like become one of my favorite UFO journals, because there were two artists whose work was featured pretty heavily in them. One was a guy named Brian James, and the other guy's Hal Crawford. And like, talk about full page illustrations in a lot of them. Like some of the most like infamous cases, kind of like the Valenzuela affair. I think it was Brian James did like one of the most infamous illustrations of it, which is like, you know, these aliens shooting at Maurice Moss and their craft sitting on the ground. It's pretty iconic at this point. But like you really can't go wrong with a good illustration. I love it.
Well, it's great because it's like a police sketch.
Yeah.
You know, describe what you saw and I'll try to draw it.
Yeah.
And then you look at it and you're like, okay, so this is basically a mugshot of an alien.
Absolutely. That's going to bring us to Herbert Shermer. And with Herbert Shermer, his story is, you know, it's kind of legendary in a sense, in UFO lore. It's kind of contactee/abductee-ish. It kind of blends the lines a little bit. Is he in the book? Is Shermer in the book?
No.
Okay. Yeah, like
no, he should be sort of right here between Reinhold Schmidt and Richard Shaver.
Oh God, good old Richard Shaver in this Darrow's.
There's Joe Simonton.
Yeah, hey, Joe Simonton is a contactee. Absolutely, you can't go wrong. So, the story of Herbert Shermer. So the early morning hours of December 3rd, 1967, were pretty routine for Herbert Shermer. And that was until he took a look at the local fauna in the area and saw that they were going a little nuts. There were dogs that were kind of just like barking like mad. And there was a bull in a corral that was like kicking at its gate pretty damn hard. So he stopped briefly to go take a look and make sure that the gate would hold. Shermer had been with the force for about 7 months by the time that he had his encounter. He was a Vietnam veteran. He enlisted in the Navy at the age of 17, though. He described himself as a conscientious objector to the war, believing that it was immoral. So he's an interesting guy in that. He claims that he was born in Missouri, but I've also seen like with his obituary, it says he was born in Mississippi, but that's like one interesting ambiguous thing. But his dad was in the Air Force, so he moved around a lot. So went to school in Japan, Germany, France, Hawaii. And when his service was up, he moved back to Missouri for a few months before he moved with his parents in Nebraska. And he kind of struggled a little bit with like clerk jobs and stuff like that. And he ultimately decided to become a police officer. So he talked it over with his dad and he suggested, hey, go become a Nebraska state trooper. So he goes to Ashland, Nebraska, and he fills out the forms. And the way that he says it, he's like 5 minutes after walking into the station, I was an Ashland police officer. They just hired me right on the spot, which is great, which is fantastic. So December 3rd, 1967, it's about 2:20 a.m. He checks on a pair of gas stations outside of town just to make sure that they were secure. And after radioing in to dispatch, he continues on. And about 10 minutes later, he's approaching the intersection of Highways 6 and 63, which is now Highway 6 and County Road 4, if you want to look at it on a map. And the first thing he noticed was this kind of row of flashing red lights. And he assumed that it was from maybe like a truck or something that had broken down. So he pulls up a little closer and he aims his spotlight at it. And this light illuminates a saucer-shaped object about 26 feet wide and about 10 to 15 feet high or so. It's hovering a little bit above the ground. And
what year was this again?
1967.
67, got it.
So he also sees that there's this like kind of landing gear jutting out of the bottom. And to quote Shermer from a presentation that he gave, it seemed like they were red flashing lights coming out of a porthole, which sort of circled the craft. It had like a catwalk going around the center of it. It was shaped like a football, very metallic, like a very shiny bumper. If you polished a bumper on a car, had sort of a red, reddish, orange glow coming from beneath it. So what's great about the presentation that he gave is like he struggles to kind of describe it. And like this is, I think the presentation is from the early 1970s. So Shermer watched as the object lifted into the air, And he feels a little weird about it. And he returns to the station, only it's 3 a.m. now. He doesn't really note the time difference, but he makes an entry in his logbook that says, saw a flying saucer at the junction of Highways 6 and 63, believe it or not. So he goes home and he starts to experience some odd symptoms. He has a really bad headache. He's got nausea, ringing in his ears, which kind of prevents him from falling asleep. And there was this kind of red welt that was like on the back of his left ear. And it kind of ran down a little bit. But Shermer ultimately kind of, he undergoes two hypnosis sessions. One at the hands of Dr. R. Leo Sprinkle under the guidance of the Condon Committee, which I always thought that was weird, because why is the Condon Committee getting involved in hypnosis? But they did. And he was later hypnotized by a second guy named Loring G. Williams. So what they revealed in that span of 30 minutes, Shermer recalls that a white flash that hit him in the patrol car, and the sensation that it was kind of like pulling the car towards this object, and it pulls him up over a bank into a field. And the experience was shocking him and made him feel, as he put it, tingly. So at the top of this field, the object landed right in front of his car. Shermer found that he just couldn't move. He was just paralyzed in the car. And then this hatch opens and this light starts to spill out onto the ground. Quote, and this form came down and looked like a human being. And then this form started walking. The figure stood approximately 5 feet tall, was dressed in a silver gray uniform and wore a helmet with a pair of antenna on both sides. They looked pretty human, except they had a flat nose, kind of a small slit-like mouth. And probably the most arresting feature of them is they had slanted cat-like eyes. So he also noticed that on the front of the uniform, there was this odd emblem, and it looked like a winged serpent. So kind of like, you know, in the medical field, they have that one emblem that has the winged serpent on it. Kind of reminds a little of that. So the being carried an object kind of in two hands, and it was described as a squarish oval type wand with a lens on the front of it. And the being aimed it at the car, which produced this green light that just enveloped the car entirely. And then what he notices and what's going to be familiar is that every time a light comes out of it, instead of just like disappearing, it kind of retracts back into it. So Shermer describes, quote, feeling nothing, like I was just there and that was it. By the time another being had exited the craft and joined the other at the car with another object that Shermer described as a kind of big pencil with a round ball on the end of it. So the being comes up to him and presses it onto his neck. And it causes him, you know, to jolt a little bit. There's a little bit of pain. And then the being stepped back and opened his car door. And again, Shermer could really only sit there. He's just sitting in his car facing forward. He couldn't even turn his head toward the beings. And he made a motion with his hand as if, you know, like beckoning him forward. And by some mysterious force, he's raised out of the car and he's standing just like right in front of that being looking down at him. And the being asked him, are you the watchman of this town? This like infamous line. And Shermer responds, yes, sir. So this is the Ghostbusters moment of if you are asked if you're a god, you say yes. This is what this is right here. So the being escorts him to the craft, and they're not walking, they're floating. So he escorts them to the bottom. They lift up into the craft, and Shermer describes this first room, quote, "And we were in a circular room, and there were a lot of cylinders about 4.5 feet high and about 2 feet wide that circled the whole room. And it had sort of like a cable running through it, two cables running through these. They looked like tall batteries to me." Which is going to kind of make sense in a little bit in what's going to happen on this ship. In the middle of the room is what Herbert described as a 20-foot long cocoon that was spinning, giving off many different colors of light, and the cables connected to some kind of like blocks. And this is this, he was told, is how the craft operates through electrical reversible magnetism. So the being leads him around, and every single time that he leads him around, he says the same thing: "Come with me, Watchman." And he leads him, and he's taken up by this kind of elevator that's just like a flat sheet of glass. And it comes down, and it takes him up to the second level. Quote, "I've never seen anything like it before in my life, with so many different types of instrument panels and computer type things that you just wouldn't believe it. This cone thing was right in the center of the floor. You could see half of it from on top and half of it from the bottom. But it gave off a red glow that sort of not flashed, but kind of died down and came back up again." So like what I'm picturing in my head whenever anybody describes light doing that, I think of that scene from This Island Earth where they're trying to escape in the airplane and they're brought up into this hangar and there's this big like green glob, a globe of lights, and it just like, you know, kind of flares up, dies down, flares up, dies down. It kind of gives me that same kind of vibe. So the being then led him to a screen on the wall and pressed buttons and flipped some switches underneath it. And a group of stars appeared on the screen, and the being stated that that was where they were from. And again, like, this is without any kind of like, this is the typical, "Hey, this is where we're from, but we're not going to tell you where it is or what it's called or anything like that. It's just, this is right. Where we're from. This is what it looks like." Okay. So
yeah,
you've kind of got that, you know, Betty Hill kind of, right. You know, star map
right. Thing. See these stars. That's where we're from.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. So he explained, that the beings were here to harness electricity. And Shermer watches as an antenna on the outside of the craft is aimed at this like set of power lines, and this multicolored bolt of energy shoots out and into these power lines. And for about 3 minutes, it starts absorbing this electricity. And then ultimately, like that wand, it returns back to the ship. So there are times where Shermer describes like he's receiving a lot of information in his head, but they're in words that he can't understand, as if the being is trying to telepathically communicate with him. But every bit of the communication that he has, it seems as if it's the way that they frame it, the being is talking to him like directly. So after he does this, a couple times, the being kind of like touches him on the shoulder in a reassuring gesture, and Shermer does the same. So the being escorts him to the glass sheet again, and they go up to a third floor, which he called the observation deck. The being led him to this observation area, which was kind of furnished with two chairs that reminded him of the kind of chairs that you see in a dentist's office. And from a big screen, that could see another being kind of walking back and forth by his patrol car. So Shermer's kind of awed by this moment. He utters the phrase, "Wow." And the being started to speak words which he couldn't understand at first. And then, like, this being says, like, one of the most profound things that I think a being has ever said to any, like, abductee. He turns to him and he says, "Watchman, one day you yourself will see the universe as I have." And then he grabs his shoulder again in a reassuring gesture, and he just urges him forward. The being stopped him again, and he felt like he was kind of receiving another one of those downloads, but yet he still really couldn't understand it. So from this point, the being escorts him back outside, prompting the other one to enter the ship that was pacing outside. And he was escorted back to his car, where again, he could just kind of feel this download of information coming that still wasn't like making any sense to him. So the being then turned, looked down at his hand again, and, you know, walked back to the ship where he floated inside. The catwalk of lights started to spin again, flashing on and off, and a reddish-orange glow erupted from the bottom. The craft ascended to about 100 feet, and then it just shot away into the sky. And after the craft departed, Shermer started to just, like, kind of come back to himself. And he just felt scared, like a totally normal reaction to something like that, but he also kind of just like felt like himself, you know. Before that, he just felt off. So when he was on board, he described feeling the way that he put it was like he felt nothing, but having returned, he was like sweating heavily, he was nauseous. And he just drove back to the station. He kind of power walked into the place because he was just so scared. He grabbed some water, smoked a cigarette, and he just kind of wondered what the hell happened. Quote, "I looked at my report log and I remembered through all the training and everything I went through that regardless of the nature of what it was, put it in your report book because you just might need it. So I looked at my report book and I got my pen out and I wrote, at 2:30 a.m., December 3rd, 1967, I saw a UFO at Junction 6 and 63, believe it or not." Another patrolman named Paul comes in a little while later, and Herbert tells him his story. Paul tells him pretty much not to say a thing. He says something to the effect of, like, "I've seen a UFO," and he starts to make up a story, and you can kind of get the idea that he's doing it to kind of reassure him that, you know, like, don't worry about it. You know, it's no big deal. And he sends him home. Paul sends Herbert home. He was going to wait for the police chief and all that, but he goes home, and before long, I think he's home for like maybe an hour or two, the police chief calls him and asks him what the heck is all this UFO business. And by that time, the press gets wind of this, and they all pretty much show up at Herbert's house. And it wasn't long before the ridicule kind of followed him too. He described kind of being like accosted on the streets, and like people would just come up to him and say, you know, "Oh, I seen a UFO too there, Herbert." And stuff like that, and kind of like, you know, joking tones. And then there were people that would call his home, his home phone, and they'd chide him saying that they were an alien. But 2 days after the incident, the police chief and a couple of officers go out there to detect if there's any radiation. And there was. It was above the average. But soon after, the Condon Committee sends John Ahrens and Roy Craig down to investigate the case, and, you know, Shermer himself to see what kind of person he was. And it was through their investigation that they realized that there was 30 minutes of missing time that they couldn't figure out. So The Condit Committee recommended hypnosis, which again was administered by Leo Sprinkle at the time. The night that he left, the folks of Ashland, Nebraska hung a dummy in the Ashland Cemetery. They hung it up by its neck and from a tree. And they basically put a big star on it and shot it with bullets. And they painted the holes red. And they put his name on it and threw a cowboy hat on it for good measure, to kind of scare him. But the way that he talks about it, he's like, I thought it was pretty funny. You know, I got a kind of a kick out of it. So he's, trying to put a positive spin on it. According to Shermer, when he was in Boulder, there was a group of people that allegedly blew up his car using dynamite. And this is something that Herbert has said himself, like in interviews, in the presentation, he said, they blew up my car. I talked to Steve Berg, past guest, all around good dude. He's like the go-to guy for stuff on, UFOs in Nebraska, anything weird in Nebraska. He's your guy because he's from Nebraska. So I asked him and he said he talked to Herb's brothers at a UFO con like a couple years ago. And he claimed that didn't happen. But I don't know why, Herbert Shermer would make that up if it did or if it didn't. And I kind of want to see if I can find any kind of newspapers that have that in it. But, it's kind of a disputed thing. But regardless, it just kind of became too much for her. He quit the police force because he felt like the press coverage was just kind of interfering with his life. According to Steve, he later became pretty religious and he died in 2017 in, I believe it's Georgia. But it's a profound kind of story. It's a really profound story of a guy who and if you listen to him give his presentation, he's a very down to earth kind of person. He's not embellishing when he talks. He is just stating things for the fact. He's like, this is what I learned under hypnosis, and he states it matter of factly. So
he had conscious recall, but then also did hypnosis.
He had some conscious recall up to a certain extent. So like the UFO incident, totally had conscious recall of it. Like what happened after that is what came forward. But what I find just so compelling about his case is how profound it is and how in the wake of it all, a guy who endured this intense kind of scrutiny, has this really profound experience that it does seemingly affect him and it influences his life. He wasn't a religious person before, kind of just, it's the textbook example of how an encounter like that can affect you and what you turn to after that. But, Herbert Shermer, and that's just one of my favorite stories because, I want to go on a UFO and I want an alien to tell me something profound while grabbing my shoulders. I just want it to happen now.
And refer to you as Watchman.
Yes, yeah. Please refer to me as Watchman. I want it to happen so badly.
So did you, when you talk about listening to him, is that on YouTube or where did you get, did you actually hear an audio clip?
Yeah, there is, one of my favorite things, is that a guy named Michael Jasorka created a comic book based on his presentation. It's called December 3rd, 1967. And, I actually have a copy of it. He basically kind of created a comic book out of this presentation. So it's a beautiful comic book. He sells it on eBay. I actually got like a copy a couple of years ago, but when you buy like a physical copy, it comes with the CD of the presentation, but there is a YouTube link to a presentation that I can send you.
Yeah, definitely.
Yep. Yeah. I'll text it to you, after we're done, but, we're pretty much there. We're at the end. This is this episode. And like, you know, one of the things that I said when we recorded part one is that there are certain cases that need to be highlighted along the way. And like these were one on next week's episode. I'm having Professor Wham back on to talk about Harrison Bailey, which we kind of talked a little bit about. Like, I think we mentioned him when we did the Tujunga Canyon one, because his name kept popping up in that book because it was investigated by Ann Druffel, his case. So right. And his case has racial overtones to it because he's a black man, and like there's a mob that confronts him about his UFO experience.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that'll be the next episode. Professor Wham actually wrote her dissertation on it. So like, which is even cooler.
Oh my God. All right. All right. Well, I mean, I don't know, Rob, have we done it? Have we proven that there were abductees before the 60s, before the Betty and Barney Hill, before all of that?
I think so. I definitely think so. I think
especially in the previous episode, I think there were cases there that were so obviously, they had the hallmarks of the later cases, but were reported early on. So yeah, now I just want to see how far back we can go.
Right. That's the tough thing. It's like, what else can we find there that indicates that these folks came forward with their abduction accounts before, you know, a certain year? And like, you know, my cutoff period right now is like 1980. That's when I kind of accept that the mainstream abduction narrative isn't there yet. It's you're going to start to see it when Missing Time is published. It's a little bit there. You could see in that one illustration in that book by Ted Seth Jacobs of Steve Kilburn's encounter. That's kind of your prototypical gray. The eyes aren't as big, but like, you know, short, like lanky kind of skinny figures with big heads and stuff like that. But, you know, the main premise is that the influence on alien abductions and what they become with like rays and stuff like that. Your year in which that takes place is 1987. So before that, what you find, and especially with, and not necessarily just alien abductions, but alien encounters are so varied. And then after 1987, you kind of have this like small group of figures that are responsible for abductions and close encounters, which include grays, lizard type beings. You're kind of Nordics. I hate using that term, but
the Nordics. Tall. Well, this Albert Coe's buddy sounds like a Nordic.
Yeah, definitely. He definitely does. But yeah, there's so much coming down the pike with the series, and there's like so many individuals as well as kind of books that need to be covered in their own. So we're ambitious here. It's
oh boy, this just sounds like more work on my plate. I just know there's going to be a text message again.
Hey Rich,
here's the book, get ready.
Hey Rich, you good for part 5, 6, 7? You know, we gotta we gotta like dissect Whitley Strieber.
Oh man, all right, why don't you, let's track him down. Let's have him on.
Yeah. Yes, we will have to do that. Rich, thank you again for coming on for this, the beginnings of this series here. I appreciate it.
Dude, we're close. We're so close.
We really are. Rich, what do you got going on these days? Like, I know you just kind of wrapped on Titans, but like, what else is going on here?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, we're kind of waiting to see what happens with season four. I was told it was our last season. Now it looks like HBO Max might be waffling. I don't know. We'll see. Well, you never
what
know.
What he's saying, folks, is that put the pressure on HBO. Do it. Just go and say you want it back for a fifth season. That's how you make it happen.
Rob, when does this episode drop? Do we know when the listening public will hear this?
Yeah, it's the second Monday in November.
Oh, dang. Okay, well, that's right around our premiere, because we premiere on Thursday, November 3rd is our premiere. So that's season four, and we premiere with two episodes. I wrote the first one. My buddy Brian Hill wrote the second one. And then every Thursday after that, another episode rolls out until we get to episode six, and then we take a break. There's a mid-season climax. Uh-huh. And then we take a break, and then I don't know how long before they air this the final six episodes of season four. And then by the time they do that, we should know if there will be any more episodes after that. So we'll find out.
Yes, we will find out.
Yeah, Titans HBO Max seasons 1, 2, and 3 are available. Right now, go watch them. And season four premieres November 3rd.
Absolutely. Yes. Go check it out. Put that pressure on HBO Max. He needs those residuals, folks. He needs them.
If I'm going to buy more UFO books, yes. Come on. Yes. What else needs am I going to spend residuals. It on?
Right.
You know, I'm not doing drugs. I might as well just buy UFO books.
Right. You know, got to make it happen, folks. This is like he's trying to live the dream, and those residuals help every single time.
A high rolling Hollywood geek, you know.
Yep.
If I'm not spending all my money, you know, in Vegas or on cocaine, it's nothing but you know, first editions by Albert Coe.
First editions by Albert Coe. And you know, if you got any leads on any George Van Tassel, he's more than happy to hear it.
yeah, shake those tassels, baby. I need some George Van.
You need some George Van. As for us at the Our Strange Skies podcast, you can find us on most podcasting apps. And while I, you know, revel in the UFO books, really what I'm looking for are good ratings, folks. Just give me 5 stars. I deserve it. I really do. Like, you know, I put a lot of work into this stuff, and I drag Rich into this because you want Rich Haddam on this podcast. You talk about it all the time and show him the love on Twitter. He needs it. He thrives on it. And, you know, it just makes my day. Give me a 5-star rating, please. Just do it. Just do it.
Just do it, guys. It costs you nothing.
It costs you nothing. Costs you nothing. OurStrangeSkies.com is where you can find most links to most things. And that resource page that I will not stop talking about ever. It's a fantastic page. It really is, because it's literally everything that I use for this podcast. I actually found a new set of resources that I ended up using for the part one of this episode of this series. That one story of I forget that one woman's name who had that weird missing time event while she was driving in New Mexico. I found that in a new resource that I didn't know about at the time, and I literally discovered it that morning. So yeah, the digital resources page, go check it out. You can find all sorts of antiquated journal links and everything. It's so great. I keep forgetting that I have a P.O. Box. So if you want to send me things, it's P.O. Box 1377 Tupper Lake, New York, 12986. And if you send him,
send him your personal UFO stories, send him gifts, just send him money. Who needs Patreon?
Yeah.
Send it directly to his P.O. Box. Gift certificates, whatever. Whatever you got, just do it.
Send it to me like you are a grandparent sending me $25 in a card. Just do it. You'll feel good about yourself for it. So, also,
Rob's birthday his birthday is right around the corner next April.
May. It's next May, but you know, like that's
or next
like,
May. I'm sorry, next May.
Yeah, that's next week practically. So, yeah, you know, if there are any, you know, giving aunties and grandparents out there, send your checks on over. But also, if you haven't checked out Welcome UFO People, the webcomic that I'm doing with my buddy Todd Purse, go check it out. We have an Instagram page. We have a Twitter page at Welcome UFO Peeps on Twitter and Welcome UFO People on Instagram. We post one a month right now because we are just incredibly busy people. And to be honest, Todd does a lot of the hard work. I just kind of boil things down into a script that I barely know how to create. So if you like webcomics and webcomics featuring obscure UFO cases, go check it out. They're pretty cool. We are a proud member of the Duveed Media family, and Spencer Worth Davis is our guy, like the man behind the curtain. He's the one. He helps out so much on this podcast. So they've helped out a lot, and we're at a different, better place now because of them. Special thanks to Floats for the use of their song UFO. Go check out his stuff. It's really good. It's really good. Like the album that the song UFO comes from is called Not an Album. You know, it's cheeky. It's funny. Go check it out. You can find him on Bandcamp, Spotify, Apple Music, all that good stuff. Megan Lagerberg did our logo, and the great Desdemona is behind a lot of our t-shirt designs. And finally, don't forget to look up, because you never know what you'll find in our strange skies or at the junction of 6 and 63 outside of Ashland, Nebraska. In gray, we trust. I saw you in the somewhere in New Mexico on the way back home. Maybe, I don't know. It was green. I think it saw me. I wish you could stay, because I got a lot to say.
Duveed Media.